Okay, I'll call this meeting, the House Finance Committee, to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:05 a.m. on Friday, March 18th, 2022. Present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. I don't think we've got anyone online. Doesn't look like it. So with that, just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones, and this morning we'll hear a presentation on the spring revenue forecast modeling update by Legislative Finance Division Director Alexi Painter. And so with that, Mr. Painter, if you can come up and go ahead and put yourself on the record and start us off.
Be a little less muffled. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. It's a little muffled with the mask. You're all 6 feet away. I think it's safe. So thank you for having me today to talk about the spring revenue forecast and update some fiscal modeling. So to start out, we're going to go over a fiscal summary that incorporates the committee substitute of the operating budget that was released 2 days ago in this committee and the spring forecast. We'll talk a little about Legislative Finance's view on the spring forecast. And then we'll do some fiscal models of both the governor's plan and some based on the on House CS2. So this is a simplified fiscal summary. I know it's a lot of numbers, but I'm just going to walk through pretty much all of it because I think this is the key thing to understand. So this reflects the spring revenue forecast as well as the committee substitute of the operating budget that this committee is working with. It also uses some placeholders from the governor's numbers, which I'll point out as we go. So on line one, you can see the total UGF revenue. Line two is the amount from the fall forecast from traditional revenue sources. Line three shows that spring revenue forecast addition. So that's $1.2 billion of additional revenue in FY22 and about $2.4 billion in FY23. POMV draw has not changed. And then we have our adjustment line. So altogether, we're looking at just shy of $7 billion of UGF revenue in FY22 and about $8.3 billion in FY23. On the operating budget, the House CS2 down here on line 8 is at $4,074,700,000 of unrestricted general funds. That's up $155 million from FY22, about 4%. A couple of months ago, I talked in this committee about how there were a number of kind of automatic negatives to reduce the budget in the adjusted base. The Senate Bill 55 adjustments to the retirement numbers, that was a significant negative. So if you actually compare to the adjusted base, which is sort of the clean starting point for this year, HCS2 is up by about 5.3% because there's those additional negatives to take into account. For statewide items, I broke them out a little bit for House CS2, and 10 should be HCS2, not HCS1, to show a little more clearly what all of these items are. So in line 9, the statewide items in FY23 is $670 million. This is an increase over what the governor had requested due to the spring forecast caused the tax credits to increase by $149 million, and also the addition of repaying debt service for the municipal project. That's about $2.4 million for those past projects, the 528 projects, as they're called, after the bill that established them. Line 10, forward funding K-12. So there's $1.2 billion deposited into the Public Education Fund to fund FY24 K-12 costs for both the pupil transportation and base student allocation formula. And just to note, as we're going to move into some of the next couple of slides, that the way that's written in the bill, it's just an amount certain. It's not an amount estimated to be. We can't really know that estimate till next year. Back when we forward funded prior to FY14 and before, we would just deposit basically our estimate based on the current year into the Public Education Fund, and then we could adjust accordingly. So you wouldn't quite often be at exactly 100% forward funding because you're estimating next year's formula, but you get you know, within a couple of percent. So that was the approach taken in this bill. The other thing about the way that was written is that it is written so that it would, if there's a deficit that arises in FY23, that deposit to the public education fund would decrease to avoid running a deficit. So essentially that's kind of a buffer against deficits. If oil prices turn out to be lower than what you expect, then under the CS, that $1.2 billion would drop as needed to avoid a deficit. So that, as we'll talk about the how this budget would react to oil prices, that's an important factor in terms of how this budget would behave. The next line, line 11, is the energy relief payment, $840 million to pay $1,300 distributed via the PFD program, but identified as an energy relief payment. So in total, that operating budget in HCS2 is about $6.8 billion, but again, that forward funding K-12 counts in part of that, so it inflates it a bit from what you'd expect as an ongoing cost.
Just a Representative Josephson?
Chair, Mr. Painter, so if you've rolled up these into the operating budget, so that forward funding is 1.2, energy relief is 8, so that's about $2 billion. You take that off at the $6.8 billion, you're at $4.8. Is that correct?
Representative Josephson, to the chair, yes, that's correct. And those are definitely the two large increases in the budget compared to the previous year.
Representative Wolf?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to follow up on that last question, if I was to compare 22 to 23, the aforementioned items from Representative Josephson, and then the last difference between 4.5 and 4.8 would be the difference in oil tax credits on line 9.
Representative Wolf, through the chair, yes, that's a major difference. Is the oil tax credit payment in FY22 was $54 million, although there's in line 12 in those supplementals, there's an additional $60 million compared to $349 million in FY23. So that's a significant increase for sure. And yeah, getting to that line 12, that's the operating supplementals. A lot of these are replacing items that were short funded last year. So the oil tax credits, adding the $60 million, adding the school debt reimbursement to get to 100%, adding the REAA fund deposit to get to 100%, adding additional money into community assistance, as well as incorporating nearly all of the governor's requested supplementals, such as $20 million for fire suppression and funding for the disaster relief fund. So there's a number of governor's items as well as those things to try to get to 100% funding for items that were short funded last year. In the capital budget, at this point, obviously we just have the operating budget in front of us, so this reflects the governor's amended capital budget and the governor's supplemental capital. There is one supplemental capital item in HCS2, but it's one of the governor's items, so rather than separate that out, I just use the governor's full amount. Most of those are not yet in that bill. Presumably they would come in a future capital bill. So at this point, we're just using the governor's amended, and on the future slides when we're looking at modeling, that's the assumption, is just using that governor's amended capital budget, because that's the one capital budget number we have at this point.
Representative Ortiz and Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So under the capital budget, line 14, current year appropriations for the governor in FY23, it's $158 million. And so, but that doesn't include the $91 million. So really his, okay, I get it. Thanks.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, so the supplemental isn't shown because we've rolled that into HCS 22. Can you clarify that again?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so there is one capital supplemental in this bill. It is one of the governor's proposed supplementals. So rather than show that separately, we're just using the governor's numbers because the others have not been considered. I don't think not including those other, you know, dozens of items necessarily means that they're not going to be included. So I think if we just showed that one, it would be a little misleading if those other supplementals are not coming forward. So at this point, for the sake of a fiscal summary, we're using the full governor's request on that line, even though one of those items is in the bill at this point. And I would note also there is one capital, FY23 capital item in the bill. It is funded with American Rescue Plan Act dollars and is federal, so it does not show on this fiscal summary. On the permanent fund line, next is the, in FY22, is the $1,100 roughly dividend that was paid out last fall, and then the approximately $1,250 dividend in HCS2 and HCS1. It's labeled HCS1, but it's in both. So that is reflects 25% of the POMV draw in that amount. So on a pre-transfer basis, sort of, again, you know, going back to a couple months ago when we talked about this, the pre-transfer deficit is really, if you look at your ongoing revenue and expenditures, you're not looking at where we're shifting money around to try to meet the deficit or using, you know, one-time fund sources like the American Rescue Plan Act revenue replacement. That's kind of what does our budget look like on an ongoing basis. And so on in line 19, there's a pre-transfer surplus of about $1.3 billion in FY22 and $532 million in FY23. So on kind of an ongoing basis, that would be your surplus. And then there's a couple of fund transfers to try to move money into the general fund. Last year, $410 million was used out of the statutory budget reserve. And then in both years, there's revenue replacement from ARPA, $250 million in FY22, and then a proposed $300 million in the second CS. There's also other fund transfers in HCS2. That's primarily replacing all swept funds out of the general fund. So the FY21 sweep was not reversed from the CBR, but HCS2 reverses it from the general fund. That costs about $437 million. There's another 14.6 of just a transfer into the SPAR account in DEC. So that's your big positive fund transfer on line 22 is replacing those swept funds.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. That 425.5, does that include the higher ed fund, vessel replacement fund? But higher ed fund is the biggest component of that line, I assume.
Through the Chair, Representative Wool, yes. The higher ed fund is, you know, nearly $400 million out of that $450. And so on line 23, you can see that the post-transfer surplus, after all of these kind of shifting money around, in FY22 is $1.5 billion, and then in FY23 is $832 million. So that's kind of what you have left at the end of the day. HCS2 is constructed so that that surplus goes into the statutory budget reserve. So in both FY22 and 23, so you can see that on the reserve balances over on the right, for the statutory budget reserve, the end of year balance in FY22 reflects that $1.5 billion being moved over, as well as the $70 million that was left over already. And then in FY23, it's that $1.5 billion plus an additional $832 million as that surplus goes in there as well. The CBR is not being really affected by this budget, so the only changes in this in the balance here are due to investment earnings and new deposits. Then the earnings reserve account, this is based on the forecast from Callan. The POMV draw is coming out, as well as inflation proofing that's included in the CS as the other activity in the ERA.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The ERA balance on that, on your graph, on your table, is pre or post POMV draw? That's post POMV draw?
Okay. Representative Wall, that's correct. Yeah, these are end of year balances after all the appropriations made in the bill.
Representative Josephs?
Chair, the inflation grouping in our bill, is it formulaic or is it just a fixed $1 billion or something?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, it's following the statutory formula, which is based on actual inflation. So the estimate that's in the bill is based on Callan's inflation assumption of 2% at the time. We've seen actually higher inflation, so in reality, that number would probably be significantly higher than the $1 billion that's projected. You know, if you assume 4% inflation, which is more what we've been seeing, that'd be, you know, twice as much, so there'd be $1 billion less. But again, that's a projection at this point.
Just as a reminder, duty to inflation proof is a may or a shall?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, it is a statute that's subject to appropriation. So in years where there were a few years where we did not inflation proof, and then there have been years where we did that extra $4 billion, as you see on the wall. Okay, so going on to the spring revenue forecast, now we've set the stage with a bunch of numbers. We can have some prettier pictures. So in that orange line there is the spring revenue forecast price path. For comparison, we have the blue line is the fall revenue forecast, and then we also pulled futures market as of 2 days ago. And then, of course, yesterday oil went up by $9 a barrel, so that line looks a little low. But it just shows kind of the volatility here in the short term that, you know, there's a difference of about $30 a barrel in FY23. But actually, the futures market is, in all of these numbers, is trending downwards. That was true in the fall forecast. It's true in the spring forecast even more so. So while there's a big spread here in FY22 and 23, 24, by FY27 or so, there's actually kind of a decreasing spread between these forecast numbers. And that reflects, you know, as we've seen, oil has been extremely volatile with world events. And the futures market does not appear to expect that this level of prices will last. How long they'll last and what the price path will be in the short term is definitely very volatile. But I think when we're looking at these long-term models, things have not changed in the long term nearly as much as they have in the short term. And that's going to be important as we look on sort of how the long term shapes up. But they definitely converge and decline in all of these scenarios.
I'd like to recognize that Representative Rasmussen is also with us. We've got Representative Ortiz and then Wolf.
On the category, in the category of oil prices and forecasts, et cetera, and then going back to the previous page under spring forecast addition $1.2 billion, in order to actually see that $1.2 billion, where do the prices need to be between now and the end of June here? In relationship to achieving that $1.2 billion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ortiz, about $115 a barrel, which was the amount, you know, when they pulled that futures market, that was where the price was at the time. You know, if the price ends up a bit lower than that, then that $1.2 billion could change for sure.
And so, based on what you're seeing for forecasts now, relatively short term because it's only to the end of June here. What are they saying the forecasts are going to, are the prices are going to be compared to that $115 per barrel?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think, when we get to the next slide, I think I can talk a little more about kind of how to think about this, but, you know, it changes daily. I mean, prices increased by $9 yesterday. And so if I had given this presentation yesterday as planned, it would have been a very different answer than today. And I think that just speaks to there's a huge margin of error on this. You know, we've seen oil prices go up by one-third in a week and a half span earlier this year and then drop by 26% in the following week. So depending on what day you're saying it, a different number is going to make sense anywhere from the mid-90s through $115 a barrel. There's just, you know, a very large span of what seems like a reasonable short-term estimate because it changes so much day to day.
Senator Ortiz?
And absolutely, I certainly agree with that. But the problem is, of course, this body has to budget based on something. And I guess in relationship to my question yesterday, what would be a safe number to estimate our to get us to what we think we might, you know, I guess sort of, let's put it a different way. What would be the minimum safe assumption that we could assume would be the real additional spring forecast? In other words, would it be safe to assume 800 million versus the 1.2 billion? What's a number that would be safe?
So, Representative Ortiz, through the chair, you know, I'm actually going to go ahead and skip to the next slide to talk about this. So just to give some background here, I started working for the Legislative Finance Division the same month that oil prices crashed in 2014. I've never been working for the Legislative Finance Division in my 7.5 years when we've had a significant amount of oil revenue. So to prepare for this presentation, I had to look back about a decade at, you know, how the division at the time talked about it. And one of the things that, you know, that my predecessor, David Teal, talked about is when you're dealing with oil revenue, you can't budget to a particular price. You should use a sensitivity chart and feel and figure out where you're comfortable. And so this is the FY23 oil price sensitivity chart. The orange line is that spring revenue forecast. And for comparison, we have the fall revenue forecast. There's not a huge difference between those lines, so we can just use the spring one. But the DOR assumption, you know, is $101 a barrel. That's where the forecast is for FY23. You know, where the question, I think, is what price makes you feel comfortable? Do you feel comfortable writing a budget that balances at, you know, $90 a barrel, $80 a barrel? So House CS2 has a number of ways that it kind of deals with this oil price volatility. One is, so it balances at $95 a barrel. So they're just at a pre-transfer level. That $532 million surplus, that goes away if you hit $95 a barrel. But there's also the $300 million of revenue replacement. That helps, you know, get you through the year. So really, with that factored in, it balances at about $91 a barrel. But then there's also the scaling down of the forward funding. So if revenue falls below that, then forward funding would go down. That gets you all the way down to $75 a barrel that the budget would balance. So as written, House CS2 with the governor's capital budget would balance at $75 a barrel, but you would lose that forward funding. So that's one way you can deal with volatility, is to say, here's, if we have the money, here's where we want it to go. If we don't have the money, then the money doesn't go there. And have appropriations like that that deal with that volatility. That's one way to deal with it. And to figure out what's kind of that floor. Is $75 a barrel safe enough that, you know, we're comfortable passing a budget? Probably. There's a relatively low chance that oil prices will be lower than $75 a barrel in FY23. What that chance is, I can't tell you. But that's one way I would say is probably a smart way to build a budget, is to make sure that depending on where the price lands, you'll have a budget that works at different price levels and that achieves different goals. So if you have more revenue, you get to forward fund. If you don't, you don't forward fund. For FY22, you know, the year is closer to the end, so you're a little more comfortable in that. In fact, if we had $0 oil for the rest of the year, we would still balance the budget currently. So the question is, of that $1.5 billion post-transfer surplus, how much of that do you feel comfortable spending given where oil prices might be for the rest of the year versus just putting in the statutory budget reserve as it is now, where obviously that can scale up and down pretty easily. You know, we would say that it's really just a policy choice for you about what makes you feel comfortable, what and how you balance those trade-offs of wanting to fund additional items versus the safety in case oil prices change. So I'm not sure that I have a single answer of like what's safe. But in the short term, it's probably hard to imagine prices going below $80 or $90 a barrel, so you can certainly bank some of that $1.5 billion. But how much you want to bank, that's kind of a policy choice of how you and where it's going, I suppose, also is another choice.
Thank you.
We've also got Representative LeBon with us as well, and we've got Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Quick point in response to your previous comment. If we did forward fund this year, which would take 1.2 and raise our sort of price that we'd need to break even, then the next year we'd only have to fund education once, so next year's budget would be reduced going forward, since this year we're sort of paying for education twice, right? That would be a future discount, so to speak, or something we wouldn't have to pay twice anymore.
Through the chair, Representative, well, I would kind of categorize it as a form of savings. So while it shows up as spending because it's technically a fund capitalization because it can be spent without further appropriation, et cetera, it really is a form of savings. And back when we forward funded, we actually reflected forward funding as a fund transfer to get it so it didn't show as spending. That's not really technically accurate, so we're not doing that now, but it's probably a better way to think about it is that when you're looking at this fiscal summary, really you don't have $6.8 billion of spending. You have, you know, $5.6 billion of spending, and this is part of how you're saving money is forward funding. So I would agree with your concept there.
Follow up. Thank you. Regards to the futures market, which we hear a lot about, and obviously in a day it changes, and over time it sort of balances out. But I'm just trying to, and maybe I should do some research on futures markets, but when we talk about what the futures market is saying, and I understand it's the price someone's going to pay not for oil today but for oil in the future, how far out would someone, like if I was going to say, I'll buy your house, I don't need it now, but I need it in 10 years, will you agree to this price? And you say, sure, not knowing what the real estate market's going to be doing. And I guess if a lot of people do that, in a way, that sort of sets what the real estate market is. So is there a certain amount of tail wagging the dog with the futures market? And I don't know. And how far out can they buy? Can they buy future oil? Is it 10 years out, as your graph says, or is it just a little bit, and then it's extrapolated further?
Through the chair, Representative, so the futures market, to kind of take your questions in reverse, the futures market goes out through FY29. That's easy to find numbers. And then Department of Revenue grows that with inflation the last couple of years of the forecast. So our FY30, I guess we have our line going through FY30. So it doesn't go on indefinitely. But after the first couple of years, no, there's not a ton of liquidity in that market. There's not as much money in that long-term market as in the early ones, as in the early years. I think the futures market is best understood as sort of a directional indicator about which direction does the market think oil is going to go. I don't think, you know, in FY27, there's not a whole lot of people that are really seriously saying, you know, putting a lot of money saying we think oil is going to be exactly $73. You know, there's not a lot of traders who are doing that. But it is useful, I think, to show as a directional indicator that most traders think that oil is going to go down over the long term. And that, so, you know, when we had prices 2 years ago when prices were briefly negative and were very low, the market generally thought that prices were going to go up. They didn't think that was sustainable, and if you looked at the futures market, it was pointing up. Beyond that, I think it's not going to be useful to the nearest dollar. It just never will be. But it is a very useful directional indicator, and when DOR did their comparison of different forecasts, it was the most accurate because it turns out that being directionally right is about as well as you can do. If you compare it to analyst forecasts or anything like that, you know, just having the right direction to your line is about as well as we can do with oil.
So I guess 3 or 4 years out, slope of the curve, that's about it. Going 10 years out is anyone's guess. Thank
you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you for your, that's been a good discussion, and thank you for that. Mine is a little more simpler. As you looked back, I don't know if you looked at these lines going back, I would assume so, but although we're looking forward, if we have about probably, it's about $30 a barrel between the fall and the spring and the futures is in the middle there. But as you look back, I mean, which, and not really the revenue forecast, but as you look back on the futures and the different types of price lines, which ones do you see that are the most accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think, you know, I think if we looked at where the fall forecast was, traders did not anticipate the war in Ukraine. You know, it was a possibility, of course, and I think, you know, and actually in an early draft of the overview, we mentioned that as a possible thing that could drive the forecast up, and I took that out because I was like, we don't want to be in that business forecasting that missed opportunity. But you know, I think that's sort of a black swan event, right, where nobody saw that coming in terms of the market. Just like COVID 2 years ago, nobody was pricing that in, nobody was really anticipating that, so it just resets the market in a fundamental way that may have repercussions for years. So I don't know that I would say that the fall forecast was wrong or that this one is right. It's based on a point in time and what the expectations are then. If I'm looking forward, you know, I would just urge caution because of how volatile the market has been and how volatile world events have been. So if you're, you know, anchoring, if you say your budget only works if you hit the spring forecast, that's going to be very risky. You may want to say, well, we want a budget based on, you know, the fall forecast and everything else is just savings. You know, that also may have a cost that you're not funding items that would help the state in some other ways. So it really is sort of this choice about the risk of oil revenue not being there versus, you know, the benefits of that additional spending you could have. So it, I don't know that I have one answer for you, unfortunately.
Follow up on that. I think what I'm trying to get to is if you look at the analysts, the futures, and then whatever our revenue, current revenue for forecast, whether it's fall, spring, or you know, this year or last year, as you look back on those lines, I mean, does anyone ever really look and see which one? I'm sure someone does because this is money, and people spend a lot of time analyzing those things. But I guess when we look at the futures market or we look at the analyst price, we see it seems like a consistent difference, like one will be lower and one's more the mid-range. I was just wondering if one's trended closer to reality than the other.
Through Chair Representative Johnson, so DOR did some of that analysis when they decided to switch to the futures market, and they found that the futures market was the most accurate number, but it still had a very large margin of error. But it was more accurate than either their prior forecast methodology or the analyst numbers, and a lot of that was just how up-to-date the forecast was, that the analyst forecasts aren't updated day-to-day, but the futures are. And so the biggest difference turned out to just be how quickly you get the numbers. The great thing about the futures market is we can get a number every day. And so it seems to be the most accurate number we have, but it still has very large error margins.
Okay, that makes sense.
Representative Josephson and then Representative Edgman.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Painter, it's the governor's proposal from his press conference yesterday would be to spend a lot of forecast increase in revenue on a dividend. There's no way to recoup a paid dividend, and we would be back in a position if oil prices fell, we'd be sort of back in a FY21 kind of world, I guess. It strikes me that if we move conservatively, the beneficiary is the 33rd legislature, because it would be left with options and opportunities looking forward. Isn't there some truth to that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, that makes sense. That, you know, the more money you leave in savings on the table, the more options that leaves for future legislators. And I think, you know, the policy choice there is whether, you know, the immediate impacts of that spending are better or saving it for the future. So for the future potential impacts of that, you know, what is the better option? And that's just, I guess, a philosophical or policy choice.
Follow up?
And the other thing, as a history teacher formerly, we learned a lot since 2014, and we spent a lot of our savings, but we needed those savings to survive, and they've covered the gap until this year. I guess I'm just making a statement that we may need savings in the future. We certainly needed $15 billion over the last 8 years. Is that right? Given our unwillingness to find other revenue.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, although, you know, if we had, let's say we had $5 billion of savings, would we have acted faster to, you know, change the fiscal system because we wouldn't have had that runway? Maybe we would have. We would have had to. So, yes, it gained us a few years where we were able to run $3 billion deficits for several years, but if we had only had a few billion in savings, we would have had to react very fast, and I guess I have confidence that this body would have acted fast enough to not crash our finances. So, yes, that savings gave us a long runway, but it gave us such a long runway that, you know, perhaps we just waited until oil spiked again rather than actually, you know, changing anything in the fiscal system. It bought us time, certainly.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, I know time is limited here. We have to be on the floor in 22 minutes, so I'll be real quick. I just want to underscore the point that Representative Wool brought forward in terms of the benefits of forward funding. I'm just looking at my notes here. We're parking that money in an account that earns a lot more than the constitutional budget reserve or the statutory budget reserve. It also gives the education community some certainty that there's, you know, assuming all this plays out, the projections that there'll be money in the account next year, because we don't know, oil could be $40 a barrel next year. I like the fact that it also potentially takes pressure off of policymakers, us in the legislature, in terms of crafting a budget next year. I again, speaking to the issue of what goes up comes down. So I just think that there's a lot of wisdom in saving that money but putting it somewhere where it can have multiple benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for also mentioning the time. We do have to be on the floor relatively shortly, and if we do run out of time, maybe what we can do, if Mr. Painter, his schedule allows, we can, whenever we come off the floor, if we have breaks, I think we might have an extended floor session today. We can do a call of the chair and then come back. And if we don't have any time, I hate to bite into the 1:30 meeting for the bills. There's some substantial bills there, so we may potentially have to push the meeting off to tonight if we can't find any time after floor session. So with that, Mr. Painter.
All right, Mr. Chairman, we sort of already talked about this slide, but just to say again, you know, this is the way that when we had passed high oil revenue, you know, legislative finance encouraged the legislature to consider oil prices, not a single point, but as sort of a sensitivity chart and figure out what level of oil you need to balance your budget. And I already sort of talked about those points, so I'll move past that. This next slide shows oil prices FY22 to date, and of course we had pulled this, did this 2 days ago, so it's through the 16th. If you did it through the 17th, you'd see a little uptick at the very end. And this is just really to highlight that, you know, throughout the year, if you look at when the fall forecast was created, that was in early December, so it's sort of this local dip, I guess, you know, a little lower than prices had been a couple months before. Prices were trending upwards throughout February, and then when the, you know, events in Ukraine happened, prices sort of got very volatile over the last month or so, and that's when Department of Revenue had to prepare their forecast. So we're just in a time that is extremely volatile in oil prices, and so while things change day to day, we just have to understand that DOR had to pick a time to run the forecast, and that's when they picked. But we don't have to necessarily be anchored to when they picked the forecast going forward, and that's again why I would kind of encourage looking at that sensitivity chart to budget rather than necessarily the point of $101 exactly, which was picked, you know, in this time of extreme volatility. You know, within that week they used in the forecast, oil went down in one day by 15%. So it's just, when it's this volatile, you can't be anchored to one number. So just to put all this again in a couple of takeaways, oil prices have skyrocketed in recent months, but the market doesn't appear that will last. It's been volatile. As I said, we had about a week and a half where it went up by 33% and then went down by 21% over the next week. And we generally encourage you to approach them conservatively, and because we have relatively small savings accounts balances and the volatility has been extremely high. So switch gears for the next little bit. Let's talk about agency operations. So as I mentioned earlier, House CS2 increases the UGF for agency operations by 5.3% compared to the adjusted base. The governor's amended budget increases by a bit over 2% above adjusted base. One of the biggest differences is, you know, how the Marine Highway System is funded. That's about $60 million. And then the other biggest difference is the $50 million outside the formula for K-12. So those are the two big differences between those paths. But I just want to highlight sort of how different agency operations paths can get over time. So the governor's 10-year plan from back in December had no spending growth in FY24 and then growth slower than inflation. So somewhere, you know, 1.5% for most items, then 1% for Medicaid going forward. That would have the budget growing from about $3.9 billion to $4.3 billion over the course of the next decade. One of the changes in the spring forecast is the Callan inflation assumption has gone from 2% to 2.25%, so these inflation slides now are going to use 2.25%, slight increase. So if you take the governor's amended budget, which is up about $15 million from the original governor's budget, and grow that with inflation, you'd end up at about $4.6 billion. That's the green line here by FY30. House CS2 is another $126 million above GovAmend, And so if you grow that with inflation, that purple line, you can see it rises in parallel, 4.76 billion or so. But if you kept up that 5.3% growth rate that HCS2 uses, you'd end up with the budget increasing by almost 50% over that period, 5.8 billion. So, you know, that spending, that difference of a couple of percent doesn't sound like a lot, but when you compound it over a decade, it can make a big difference. And, you know, I think it seems unrealistic to say, well, we're not going to grow at 5.3% a year. You know, there's special reasons to do that now. We've been holding agency operations flat or lower for several years. We haven't funded K-12 in several years. But if we look at sort of the past, we can see that when we've had oil revenue in the past, we have grown agency operations much faster than inflation. So from FY04 to FY13, the agency operations nearly doubled, going from 2.118 basically billion to 4.3 billion, an annualized growth rate of 7.9% over that period. And this is using the final budget, so including supplementals. You know, in those first years, basically agency operations are growing at 10% a year. And so it's very possible that if revenue stays high, the legislature will, you know, spending pressure is always upwards on those things, that spending will grow faster than inflation. So even that 5.3%, you know, if we have an extended run of high oil prices, maybe that would look conservative if we, you know, repeat the past path. And I have a quote here from the LFD overview of the governor's budget back in FY13, talking about, you know, looking back at that expenditure growth. And really, when you're looking at agency operations, there's kind of two reasons why we look at that so much is, you know, not only, of course, you're spending money, so there's less in reserves, but also it's hard to back off from that. You know, it's easier to move your capital budget up and down and one-time items up and down than agency operations. That's just very difficult to ratchet back. And so if you look at this, you know, when we did see oil prices crash, we didn't go back to FY04 levels. That, you know, clearly that was not possible. We made it basically back to FY11 levels, which, I mean, that's something that's almost unprecedented among other states. We haven't seen other states that have managed to cut the budget in the way that Alaska did. But we were not able to completely go back to where we were before, or anywhere close to it. So when you're looking at, you know, spending going forward, increasing agency operations, you know, does make it a lot harder to balance the budget in the future and increases the likelihood of the need for new revenue or either in the form of, you know, PFD reductions or in terms of new taxes. This is the biggest lever that we have to control the long-term path is agency operation spending. And so, you know, on these next few models that hopefully we'll get to a little bit of, you know, we're going to look at these different agency operations paths essentially and see how that could go, how that could play out going forward. So the first one is the governor's original 10-year plan with the spring forecast. So that, you know, with agency operations, as I said, is growing slower than inflation and has 50% of the PMV draw going to the dividend. And that shows significant surpluses each year, so about a $2 billion surplus in FY23. But because revenue is higher now, but, you know, hasn't changed that much from the fall forecast in the out years, the deficit or the surpluses by, you know, FY27, 28 are still not huge, even with growing slower than inflation. So, you know, looking at these surpluses, you'd say, well, this is going to work forever. But, you know, it doesn't yield large surpluses forever just because of, you know, the fact that oil is projected to go back down. And if we compare that to the governor's amended budget growing with inflation using the spring forecast, we see that, you know, we do see deficits in these later years because even with the higher forecast and the governor's, you know, spring budget that was written at the fall forecast, it's still fundamentally in the long term hasn't shifted that much. The big difference is that reserve balances are much higher. So when we ran these models back a couple of months ago with the fall forecast, you know, reserve balances in the governor's scenario were pretty low. They were getting down to, you know, $1 billion or so. In these models, because we have big surpluses in the early years, the reserve balances are built back up. They're, you know, $6-7 billion. And so, yeah, there's a couple of small deficits, but it doesn't really affect your reserve balances because there's that cushion built up. So then the next one is the House CS2 growing with inflation, assuming that after this year the energy relief check is kind of a one-time item, and then the PFD is 25% of POMV. And with that, you see, you know, pretty big surpluses every year, 900 million, 800 million. You know, that 75-25 dividend plan based on House CS2 growing with inflation produces just very large surpluses. I know I'm going fast, but I'm trying to get through the next few slides here.
And I was going to suggest one option, too, is if you wanted to continue just touching on these and move relatively quickly, and then if the committee wanted, we could always, whenever floor session's over, we could come back for 20 or 30 minutes just so that we could take our time and folks could ask questions. And it's just an option. We don't have to if folks feel comfortable with where you're going right now, but go ahead and continue.
So the next one assumes that, you know, the energy relief check and or whatever, you know, larger PFD amount of 50% POMV goes forward, however you'd characterize that. And with HCS2, that, as we've seen, has surpluses in the early years. Note that the surpluses kind of spike, and that's because the oil tax credit payment goes away after FY24 and decreases in FY24 as well. That's one of the reasons, as well as the forward funding of K-12 that, as Representative Wohl pointed out, a one-time item. And so with that 50-50 and HCS2, you'd have some significant deficits in the last few years. Where it ticks up here, that's because in the revenue forecast, they have the futures market runs out and then they start growing with inflation. So oil goes up that last year, which is why there's an assumption of a surplus that year. However, the last couple look at if you grow by 5.3% per year. So continue the growth rate that's established in HCS2 going forward. So even with that 75-25 that with growing with inflation was, producing nearly $1 billion of surpluses, there would be surpluses for most of the period, but running into deficits by the end, even because that's how big of a lever that agency operations growth rate is. You go from $1 billion surplus to a couple hundred million dollars, or $800 million surplus to a couple hundred million dollars in deficits, just because of that agency operations difference. And then the last one would be if we did the 50-50 going forward with that 5.3% growth rate, still have surpluses in the first few years, but they turn into pretty large deficits, starting in FY26, but really expanding to over $1 billion from FY29 going forward. So the point being that, you know, the governor's proposal of the 50-50 dividend works in his models, the spring revenue forecast, in large part because of the expenditure growth rate. If you grow at a faster rate, you know, the picture looks very different. And
And I think what we'll do, we'll take Representative Josephson's question, but I think what I'll do is I'll go ahead and recess, and then if members want to come back, we don't have to, but if I hear folks wanting to come back, we can come back after a floor session at some point, just call the chair, and it might even be just 15 minutes or, you know, it could be short. And then if I don't hear from folks wanting to come back later, then we'll just let this 9 a.m. meeting time out. So with that, Representative Josephson.
The Chair, Mr. Painter, some of these are realized ERA balances seem larger than we're used to seeing. Not hugely larger, but somewhat. Wouldn't that create temptations for an overdraw? Unless we do another one of these enormous inflation proofings?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, it could. And then this particular scenario, we do have an overdraw in the last year to balance the budget. And in some of these, you know, even in this scenario, for example, where there's deficits in the last few years, there's an SBR balance of, you know, 7 or 8 billion, that may create a temptation for additional spending in those years too, as well as having that ERA balance. There'd be a lot of cash on the table that may make, you know, it difficult to even, it's hard to, you know, when you have surpluses year after year of 1.8, 1.2 billion, there certainly would be a pressure to spend as well as that ERA balance.
So we may come back later. I'll do a call of the chair if we want. So we'll go ahead and recess. But our next meeting, if we don't come back, is scheduled for this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. And Co-Chair Merrick will be hearing House Bill 149, Child Care Provider Collective Bargaining, as well as House Bill 289, Alaska Marijuana Industry Task Force, and SB 9, which is the Alcohol Beverage Control Bill. As a reminder, amendments for the operating and mental health budgets are due to my office by Friday, March 18th. That's today at 5 p.m. And so with that, we will stand at recess. And time is currently 9:56 a.m.